I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And we're building bridges, not walls.
Now, slavery by any other name, the exploitation and abuse of incarcerated workers.
When will they be paid for the work they do? We must abolish the 13th Amendment exclusion that allows slavery and involuntary servitude as punishment for a crime. It's past time to end slavery in all its forms, including in prisons. And we are extremely pleased to have with us Kwesi Kanadu, Professor of Americana and Latin American Studies at Colgate University, and Professor Ruben Garcia, Professor of Law, Co-Director of the University of Nevada Workplace Law Program. And why don't we start with that very question? Should people who are incarcerated be paid for the work they do? Or do we really have a system of involuntary servitude and slavery? And if so, how did that come about? And why don't we start with our dear Professor Kwesi?
Well, thank you very much for having me. I think the question perhaps should be rephrased as to what are the power dynamics or relationship that enables the enslavement of labor. And if you think about the question that way, then the person need not be a convict, or it could be a chattel, or it could be anyone else whose labor could be appropriated, you know, for the use of someone else or some organization's else. And so in many ways, a lot of emphasis has been placed on the 13th Amendment as having this exception clause or loophole for the enslavement of incarcerated labor. And that argument does hold weight, but I also want to at least lay out for discussion that several states have abolished that clause in their state constitution, such as Colorado 2018, Utah, and a few others. And those states still enjoy the benefit of the labor of their incarcerated persons, and the clause has been eliminated from state constitution. So I think we have to rethink this idea of slavery as being an institution or being a system, and rather think more likely that slavery is more a relational power dynamic that can exist in and outside of the dominant features of plantations, whips, and cotton.
And Ruben, to bring you into the conversation, anything you want to say with regard to bouncing off Kwesi, or do you want to continue the discussion in the effect of the harmful effects of this kind of exclusion from the 13th Amendment?
Well, thank you also for having me, and I just want to agree wholeheartedly with my colleague, Professor there, because he's right that some states have chosen to eliminate the exception clause, which tracks federal constitution and its exception for slavery or involuntary servitude for punishment as commission of a crime for which the person has been duly convicted. But that is simply an allowance of, the history that has been well documented, sought to continue slavery by another name. So that was part of the 13th Amendment in 1865, which is a very emancipatory amendment and an amendment about labor emancipation, which myself and other scholars have written about. But there are, of course, choices that can be made by states and state legislatures to either prohibit this kind of labor or to compensate it with full employment rights. And as my colleague said, simply removing the exception does not end prison labor or does not require that prisoners be paid for the work that they do. So that's a much broader campaign, I think, that is continuing and will continue even after the exception is, if it's removed from the state or federal constitutions.
Well, professors, one of the things I'm most interested in is, first of all, just how broad this issue is. I mean, what kind of numbers are we talking about of women and men, people who are incarcerated? Also, we know that there have been an enormous number of strikes of immigrant labor that has been held in detention, people who are without papers, who have been forced into labor situations. So how broad is this? And what is it power relationships still, or is it really about the profitability of labor that has no negotiating power being mercilessly exploited by corporate system whose work that they're doing?
I think it's a combination of both and perhaps a little more. And it sort of has to be the combination of both because if you think, for example, at the turn of the 20th century in the early 1900s, places like Georgia had ended convict leasing in 1907, and there was severe economic, blows to several industries, including brick mining, as well as coal mine industries. And without access to cheap labor, many of those industries collapsed or suffered severe losses. And so if you think about that a century ago and sort of fast forward to today, in New York State alone, over 35,000 incarcerated people produce approximately $53 million in annual revenue. States like New York and Georgia of old, and certainly Georgia of today, that revenue is crucial. In fact, I think the ACLU had put out a report last year that prisoners produce more than $2 billion in goods annually and essentially provide more than $9 billion worth of services while being paid anywhere between, on average, 6 cents to 64 cents, per hour. So it's always a combination of, again, power dynamic, the power to reduce, people to a form of chattel and cheap labor, and the power to legislatively, if not otherwise legally, keep those systems, intact.
Just to say again that this is a system that is interlocking in a number of different ways, right? You have obviously the maintenance and services of the prisons that the workers are basically held in, as my colleague said, estimated about $9 billion a year for that. But when you have, again, goods and services that are out on the private market, right, that private companies who contract with these states and prisons benefit from, again, you're talking about profits that exceed what would ordinarily be the market price for those goods and services. So if you produce $2 billion a year in goods and commodities, and you have to pay workers anywhere from $7.25 an hour to maybe $15 or $18 an hour, you have a lot more profit in that $2 billion than if you only have to pay, as we've seen, between 17 and 87 cents an hour, right? So that is really hard to quantify, really, in terms of the saved profit on labor. And in terms of immigration or immigrants who are kept in detention, right, this is clearly not within the scope of the 13th Amendment at all, because these workers are not convicted of any crime. They're being detained often in waiting for their immigration hearing. And yet the private companies that run these detention centers have put them to work for cents on the dollar, and it's been subject of litigation in federal and appellate courts that this is not within the 13th Amendment, and that's one of the things, again, that many courts have stumbled upon, I think, unnecessarily, because, again, the 13th Amendment just says there can be this labor, but it doesn't say anything about whether it's compensated or not. We have a lot of statutes that say if you're an employee doing work for an employer, you are owed the minimum wage and other basic protections. So that, again, is that litigation will go on, I think, probably for several more years now.
And what are some of those other protections? I'm talking about protections like occupational safety and health, worker safety. I'm talking about the right to form unions and to strike. I'm talking about a whole number of federal protections that labor enjoys. even though these people are being totally exploited by the amount of work, by the amount of salary that they're getting, in some cases almost nothing, what are some of the other factors that enter into this?
Well, yes, and it's hard to imagine a situation where an employee is more under the control of an employer than in a prison situation. And yet, that's the touchstone for when you have all of those protections and all the different things that come from being an employee, working for an employer, workers' compensation, health and safety, the right to strike and bargain collectively. And these are the kinds of things that could be, you know, granted or could be extended specifically to prisoners, whether by state or federal law. But because the law is so broad in terms of these only being available to employees, that's why you have courts saying we just can't see these protections also extending to people in prisons.
And we're speaking with Professor Ruben Garcia, who you just heard, and Professor Kwesi Kanadu. And Professor Kanadu, I'm most interested in the issues of, in your work and the very important writings that you've done on this, what's been your connectiveness with various groups behind the walls? Is there a kind of, how do you see them regaining, and to what degree have they communicated the resistance to this enormous exploitation, both certainly economically and most strikingly, as you put it, as an additional method of control, indeed using people as chattel?
Certainly, and I want to make clear that I don't necessarily belong to an organization that is, you know, sort of working with prisons behind the scene, even though I do follow much of the developments that were under discussion now. But I will say that there are many activist groups and campaigns in New York, for instance. There's the 6th, the 13th New York campaign that is working with lawmakers and legislative leaders in Albany to enact a minimum wage for incarcerated people, and they're looking at pushing that rate, which is currently, I think, starting around 16 cents per hour. They're looking to increase that, but also to amend the New York State Constitution to prohibit prisoners from not being forced, intimidated, or otherwise compelled to do involuntary labor. Those kinds of efforts are ongoing, and however, I don't see them paying much fruit. Because, again, we circle back to this power dynamic, not simply the revenue that prisoners bring into New York State, but the power dynamic here is that that campaign, the 6th to 13th New York campaign, has only gotten moral support from New York City rather than New York State legislatures. And that should tell you enough that there isn't any particular political will or convincing of the powers to be in Albany to enact, and even the governor, Governor Hochul, announced sort of jobs to jail initiative. But that, of course, is premised on the idea of people who actually leave prison rather than those who are in prison. So these efforts combined, they suggest something is being done, but ultimately, they don't get away. They don't get at, you know, the heart of the power dynamic here, because, you know, the prisoners, they don't have a political voice, and certainly you don't campaign as an elected official. You don't canvass the prisons for vote, right? So they're almost casted outside of the political sphere. They've also casted outside of the sphere of being citizens, right? And so these kinds of castings is a direct result of what I'm referring to as slavery as a power dynamic, as a power relationship, and in these cases of power, simply pushing for legislative reform, simply picketing and boycotting, isn't sufficient to move the levers of power in either direction.
Ruben, I know there's a campaign in Nevada centering on some of these issues, especially minimum wage. You want to talk about what's happening in Nevada?
Sure, but I couldn't agree more with my colleague there on this, the political problem here for advocates and for prisoners, of course. It is, of course, a political issue that, you know, will continue. And even when you have, you know, felon reenfranchisement and other kinds of strategies, there's still such a political challenge here. And it's you know, as we've been talking about, I mean, in any particular state, it may be possible to remove the language from the Constitution, but there's still a lot of power dynamics and forces that keep the system as it is, right? And that's kind of been the experience here in Nevada, at least legislatively. There have been a couple of bills to require the minimum wage for prisoners that haven't gone anywhere in the legislative session. But there's also litigation strategies. So there have been attempts in the state Supreme Court to extend the minimum wage, which is a part of our Constitution here in Nevada, to prisoners that failed in the Supreme Court, failed in the attempt to also provide workers' compensation based on minimum wages to prisoners, also failed in the Supreme Court. And it's all really bound up by this idea that the federal courts have not ever extended minimum wage or labor protections to prisoners. And so that's been under the statute. But as I mentioned, there's certainly strategies and attempts to bring at least the spirit of the 13th Amendment as an emancipatory provision to bear, and to say that was really what the Congress was trying to do in 1865, was to end these kinds of exploitive economic conditions, and that's what the language of, you know, slavery or involuntary servitude shall not exist in the United States really means. And that is, of course, going to take some time for the courts to, if it happens, it's not going to happen soon. But the fact is, of course, that a lot of people are talking about that language as providing a minimum floor for labor standards. And again, I think that this litigation involving immigration detention might also raise this issue in the courts to make some headway in terms of some of that federal case law that has been problematic in many states.
You know, one of the things that had been raised on this program at one point, and I should say most categorically, certainly I am a prison abolitionist, but this was raised the issues of, there are some countries that have begun to look at labor that is behind the walls, in a way, creating projects to create cooperatives where there actually would be specific training, where there are social development, where there is decision-making made amongst the peoples themselves, and where they actually can have some reserve of funds when they get out. And indeed, in some of these places, actually, people have continued to relate to the work effort. I'm just interested in what you think about that as a way of kind of responding to this. But also, if I can just throw in a little sidebar there, is somehow, I mean, we are in a country now where there is, in many places, the restoration and emphasis on chain gangs, where we still have the plantation system as it was originally intended in places like Angola Correctional Institute. So how are we to really understand the politics of the issue of using captive labor as a, again, a method of social control, and what Professor Kwesi Kanandu was talking about earlier, which is these power dynamics in our society?
Well, if I may jump in very quickly, that globally, I think to one of your questions, globally, there are a number of places that I think have tenants, or at least approaches that I think make much more sense. And look, for example, look at Germany and the Dutch prison systems that are sort of organized around this, you know, resocialization, rehabilitation, and some of the Northern European countries. I think they do a much better job at addressing prisoners as people, but also prisoners as a kind of citizen, you know, who have been incarcerated for one or a series of, you know, convicted crimes. So I think globally there are a number of places that do prisons and prisoners quite differently from here. Here, the profit motive is central. And so, for instance, as you mentioned, think of Arkansas. Has some of the largest cotton production prisons in that state. And it is that state that helps the United States become the third largest producer of cotton globally behind China and India. And in these places like Arkansas, Florida, Louisiana, Texas, with these penal plantations, you know, you see often these black men picking cotton, other crops, under the watchful eye of these armed white men on horseback. That's not an idyllic, you know, picture from the past. That's happening right now. So the power dynamics are very much real. And in terms of legislative efforts, you know, you think of a place like Illinois that has a Democratic governor, and Democrats control both chambers of legislature. And there was a bill to end prison, you know, slavery. It's called the End Prison Slavery Act. And it went nowhere. So even in places that are controlled by, you know, a political party, a party that's supposed to be of the people, been no action, you know, on a bill like that. And lastly, in five states, I think, on the ballot, November 8th, five states asking voters to amend the constitutions to do away with the exception clause that my colleague and I have been, you know, talking about. And they include Alabama, Louisiana, Oregon, Tennessee, and Vermont. And so some people are, you know, hoping that, that may change. But based on what we've said thus far, based on the evidence, and most legal experts agree that those measures are not likely to have an immediate legal effect on prisoners' labor conditions and on whatever pay may come for their labor.
Right. And I, if I may jump in as well with the sort of a global look, I think this is a very long-term campaign. As we heard, it's not going to happen very quickly. But I think it does move us towards looking at our international, both our international counterparts in terms of how they incarcerate people, but also the international human rights provisions that the United States has signed on to. And many of those provide for dignity and the ending of exploitative circumstances that violate human dignity and incarcerated situations. And so that may be, the Supreme Court, of course, is not particularly favorable place to be right now, but long-term, these strategies in terms of making this a human rights issue, I think will have to be continue to be pressed in legislatures and in courts down the road.
And Reuben, quickly, because we're running out of time, you're involved in something called the 13th Amendment Project. What do they do, and how can people reach this organization to receive more information?
Well, the 13th Amendment Project is a group of scholars throughout the country that are interested in new approaches to the 13th Amendment, particularly economic ones, and it is held conferences and hosted events on different aspects of the 13th Amendment, and it might include seeing the 13th Amendment as a minimum labor standards requirement that states and private parties are actually obligated to enforce. It's a really sort of a research group, not an, a group of, you know, that's engaged in any kind of service or campaign. But we do, again, have collect research on this topic at our online repository at UNLV. So that's what the 13th Amendment Project is. And hopefully there will be future gatherings and as people get back together again, in the coming months and year.
Professor Garcia, give us a website. And Professor Conadu, tell us where people can get a hold of your excellent article on these critical issues while we continue to fight to eliminate the carceral state for good. And, of course, always to remember to support the incredible strikes that have been going on throughout the prison system and some of the most oppressive of the prison systems. And slavery by any other name, the book itself, Douglas Blackman, something to read. So how do people get in touch with you, find the articles and so on? Professor Garcia, Professor Conadu?
Well, the 13th Amendment Project research repository is at scholars.law.unlv/amend13.
Professor Conadu?
And people can find out more at www.kwasiconadu, that's KWAASI, Conadu, KONADU, .info.
And I hope you'll both come back and we can explore this more comprehensively, more fully, because, one, democracy is not a spectator sport, and we really have to work to support people behind the walls who are fighting for fundamental human rights and continue to fight to eliminate the carceral state in total. So I thank very much our guests, Kwasi Conadu, Ruben Garcia, and it has been a pleasure being with you. I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
And I'm Ken Nash.
For Building Bridges, and as we say, we build bridges, not walls.